Hello, and welcome to the Brown Right Podcast. Hey! Hello. So today I have a very, very special guest. She's a TV host, actor, DJ, producer and writer. She's hosted video hits, The Voice and the Sydney Gay and Lesbian Mardi Gras. In 2017, she made her stage debut with Sydney Theatre Company and Melbourne Theatre Company's co-production of the Molière award-winning play, The Father. She's toured Australia and New Zealand as Oprah Winfrey's resident DJ, and she's written for Sunday Life, Huffington Post and Women of Letters. Her most recent work, Sam, explores loss, grief and her African identity and is part of the first collection of African-Australian stories in Australian letters called Growing Up African in Australia. She's a strong, intelligent voice on queer issues and racial equality. She is the amazing, inspirational Faustina Agoli. Welcome, Faustina.
Thank you so much for having me, Ant, on your podcast. Thank you for the introduction.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for being here and spending a little bit of time with us. As always, I just wanted to kick off with a bit about your family background. So your father was from Ghana and your mother is Chinese. You were born in London. Mm-hmm. You later moved to Australia, here to Australia. Mm-hmm. Can you just tell us a bit about what it's been like growing up with that background?
Having this background, being multiracial, being Chinese with a Malaysian influence because mum was born in China, being Ghanaian, has been so incredibly enriching in my life. And it's just something that I just tie into with love for me. I grew up in a family that was very supportive of me no matter what. I tend to hear stories from other friends that have been mixed race where perhaps like one side or both sides of the family have racial tensions, and therefore it's that sort of bleeds into the family and affects the children. But I thankfully have not really been on the receiving end of the impact of that. But for me, you know, you mentioned the story Sam and growing up African in Australia, and that is in regards to my father. So he passed away in London when I was 7 weeks old, unfortunately. He was working a night shift at the hospital. He was a trained nurse in the psychiatry ward, and he did a night shift, came home, said that he needed to go out to see a friend this particular day in London. My mum said, please just stay home and rest. He said that he didn't want to. It's believed that he was going off for a job interview to try and just get a better job to help raise our family. And he fell asleep on at the wheel on the way home from this appointment. He suffered, I think, a brain injury from the car accident and died from a blood clot that moved from his leg to his lungs in the middle of the night, at least two or three days after the accident. So it was a very sudden passing. And it was, my mum had a son who was 7 years old, my older brother, and me at 7 weeks. And this is in 1984 in London. Mum has some family in relation to my dad in London, but most of her family now has relocated from Malaysia to Australia. So there was a lot of isolation and grief for her. And then after a year of being in London, we were able to get access into Australia. We could finally migrate. It was always our intention as a family to migrate to Australia for a better way of life, better educational opportunities like most migrant families seek here. And we spent we spent 6 months in Malaysia and then finally settled in Melbourne, Australia. I lived in a multi-generational Chinese household with my Chinese grandparents, my mum, my brother, two of my Chinese cousins, Valerie and Corinne, who I still, they're like sisters to me. I adore and love them. They now live in Sydney. And then we had my Chinese Australian cousins come visit at least every weekend. So it was like, it was popping. It was so good. So I felt very Chinese. My Chinese identity was reinforced every single day. And like I was eating Chinese food all the time. I went to Chinese school on the weekends. But growing up in a multicultural suburb in Australia, which I can't say is every Australian burb, definitely isn't. I just was fortunate that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the things that I found was the most interesting in this, in the story, Sam, the short story, Sam, was the thing where you talk about the sort of the mixed race upbringing. That really resonates with me because I'm quite mixed myself. I'm kind of partly Anglo-Indian, partly Bangladeshi, partly British as well. I found that for me, growing up was really interesting. I kind of found that I fitted in lots of places. But then also I didn't fit in as well. I kind of sometimes used to think, oh God, I wish I could just be, because I had a lot of friends that were black, and think, oh, I wish I could just be black, or friends that were white, could just be white, and sort of being sort of a bit of everything sometimes was challenging. Did you find that? I know you sort of used to, obviously you're black and going to dim sum or to your Chinese family, you would have stuck out.
Yeah. Oh, enormously. My brother and I, people would do double takes at the Chinese restaurant and not understand the association, which, you know, I think it's really funny because it was like, I was never made to feel that way from my family or my grandparents. My grandparents love me like 100. And so it was almost like, well, everybody else seems to have a problem with this. So I don't have a problem with it. I don't know why y'all can't wrap your head around the fact that this is my mum, and why is it such a surprise to you? Do you know what I mean? And so, but yes, the visibly black thing though, for me, has been a journey because I was so reinforced with Chinese identity that my blackness wasn't actually reinforced. You know, because I was constantly having to try and prove my Chinese-ness, actually, which is, I guess, the challenge that it was presented to me on my individual level. But I think for me, what reinforced my blackness and my links to Ghana was us taking a trip to Ghana in my teen years to, you know, discover that side of the family and reconnect with them, which I do detail in the book. And also, I have British, black British cousins, which is super relatable because, you know, they are part of the diaspora. They are also Ghanaian. Some of them are full Ghanaian. Some of them are Ghanaian French. And there is a familiarity there that I feel like parts of me do come alive. So, yeah, you're totally bang on in terms of parts of you coming alive there. But I also don't feel the sense that that there's something missing in those groups for some reason. But I would say that, though, of my queerness, of being a lesbian, I feel like I can only be my true self, or my fullest self, I guess, when it comes to that dimension of my queer identity, when I'm with cool queer peers. And that's only really happened. There's only been one day in my life in the 36 years that I've been on this earth where I felt that fully. And that was when I was, of all places, in DC, in the US. This was like right before this last presidential election. And I was just traveling around the area and went to a queer mixer thing that was more women skewed, and just found my people in the sense that people from all walks of life, and it just seems like, you know, like kind of like the brain trust, like the lesbian brain trust of the United States was just all there. And it was just epic, like, you know, just having wonderful conversations with women that were very switched on, and I had a keen sense of social justice. And so maybe those were the things that came into alignment for me. But, you know, my Chinese-ness was missing in that environment as well. So in terms of like reinforcement through other people that I was interacting with. So, but I just, you know, I guess, you know, the onus is on me. I got to just bring my full self to a room every single time. Whether or not that's reflected back to me, I guess that's on everybody else to kind of level up.
Yeah, I hear you. It's interesting because my wife's Chinese, so my kids are half Chinese. So they're very, like you, kind of had an upbringing with all of their Chinese family and extended family. They're very kind of connected to that side of things. We live in Australia, so, and all their mates are Aussie, so they're very Aussie.
By Aussie, what do you mean? Like white Australian? Sorry, I want to clarify that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean more because the schools, well, my younger son's school is quite mixed. I mean more everyone's got an Aussie accent, to be honest.
Oh,
they've
I see.
All got,
okay.
They've all got an Aussie accent, but it's quite a rainbow nation.
This is a
school in the eastern suburbs, and they are kind of, there's lots of all sorts of different racial mixes. But what I was thinking is just to your thing about going back to Ghana, because I was actually really moved by that bit in your story where you talked about going back to Ghana and connecting with your gran, the eating mm-hmm. eating the food that she made and it being just super super spicy. I kind of all my life have wanted to have more of a connection with my Bangladesh side. That's where my granddad was from. That's where I was actually born. And I really want my kids to have that connection with our family in Bangladesh as well. We've still got some sort of relatives over there. So for years, I've been trying to persuade the boys that we should go there and, you know, they could meet people and learn some of the language and the food. But they've got no interest. Maybe it's because how old are they? They're 10 and 13. So maybe they're too young. But they've, you know, they're like, oh, no, we want to go to America or New York or Japan or somewhere cool. When I show them pictures of Bangladesh, they're just like, oh, my God, that looks horrendous. Right. You know, just in terms of, you know, maybe it's just teenage kids that, you know, but you, how old were you? You were 15,
yeah,
were you?
Yeah,
you
I think I was like in year 9 going on to year 10 maybe. And I've actually been told, so this is an interesting kind of psychological point. I've been told from school teachers when I talked about this pivotal year of going back to countries that are a part of my roots, well, and specifically Ghana. I guess the lure as well was mum took money off the mortgage and it was a round the world ticket. So it was like we were planning for, we did the Disneyland thing as well. We went to Hawaii, we went to New York City, but like the first part of the trip, the first stops was South Africa just to see family and friends and because it was just a stop that we needed to take. And then it was Ghana. I think, you know, so, you know, one usually can't have any expectation if that particular country has not presented dominant images in the white system that we live in, which is media, which is, you know, storytelling through all these mainstream networks, right? So there is no real nuance or storytelling that incites me as a child back in the early ooze and or the 90s and for your children present day, right? Like how can you have a sense of pride if everything that you're consuming is like cool American, right? And then add that layer to that, but back to this whole psychology thing of you know being in a certain year level. Apparently, this year 9 year is actually so crucial for a child's development, and it can their experiences in that year can determine how like if they decide to overachieve or superachieve in their final years of school, or kind of become a bit complacent. And there are certain schools that are set up to have particular camps or, you know, personal development camps in that time. I think for children that are a part of a diaspora of some kind where they have settled into Australia and have some sort of roots elsewhere in the world, I think that is the year that you got to go. You got to go to another, you got to go home to your country and to go visit that place because that trip for me solidified so much. I understood that the world was a lot larger than the whatever the internet was at that time and what my textbooks were telling me. I actually started to understand the visceral connection of colonialism when I got over to Ghana and I went to the slave ports and what have you. I understood that I had a linkage to someplace else. Knowing my roots was so important and knowing that and coming back to Australia gave me a fresh perspective of Australia in the sense that, yes, this is not a perfect country, but what my family lineage has taught me is that they've worked so freaking hard for me to get to this point and to have privileges that they couldn't possibly have. You go back one generation, my mum never went to university. All she wanted was for my brother and I to go to university, right? And so once I realized that, I was like, oh, man, I've been a brat this whole time. Like I've skipped school. I've been disinterested. I've not cared. And all of a sudden, I cared. I felt like I had purpose in the world. I felt like really if I put my mind to something, I can achieve it. Like the world was my oyster.
That was kind of a self-discovery coming from that trip or from that moment of connecting.
Totally. So it was Ghana and it was as well as America, you know, the best parts that we get from America too. I'm not trying to slag off the States at all. Like the States are highly problematic, especially now. Like they're exposing all kinds of wounds that are over 400 years old. But there are things about the culture that rub off on us And sometimes we, I would hope, in exponentially positive ways. And so I think that that's that sort of energy that I hope informs your kids when you do decide to go back to Bangladesh. Like, it'll be discovery for you. It'll be discovery for your kids. And I was having a conversation with another woman, another person the other day, where I was like, who was also mixed race. And I'm just like, you know what? Our identity has no endpoint. It's a constant self-discovery, especially if you've, you know, got roots elsewhere in the world. Like, it's constant. Like, so yeah, it's just worth embracing. And, you know, we might not have these moments of huge epiphanies here or there, but it all adds up to something eventually.
Yeah, it's interesting what you're saying about the our roots having no endpoint as well. That really resonates with me, because what my whole family found actually is coming over from parts from India and parts from Bangladesh in the sort of 50s, 60s, 70s was that's a whole kind of universe. Bangladesh, very different to Pakistan, very different to India, the religions, the different areas. But my family got to London, and what white English people saw was just brown. Oh, just brown
so
people.
Reductive.
You're all the
so
same.
Reductive.
There's my family. We're not like those guys. We're like this, and those guys are different because of that. But yeah, what people saw was just, oh, there's some brown guys. Let's lump them all in. So I think it was frustrating probably for the generation before me, for my parents and their parents, trying to sort of explain to people, look, there's a whole universe of different colors and cultures and customs going on here, and you're reducing us all to one thing that you're not even getting right. Yeah, which is a shame. And then I think, like you were talking about the kids thing, I think I don't know, because I feel like my son, who's 13, he's into streetwear and sneakers and stuff. I feel like he's more in touch with Black American culture than he is with, you know, his actual background. And I think that's just because that culture's got music and sport and Michael Jordan and all of these kind of super cool things, but Bangladesh hasn't really got that. It's got some okay cricketers and some some sort of all right food, but it hasn't made a mark on the, you know, whether the white sort of the white culture has let it in or not. I don't know if it's had that much to offer to the world so far.
Yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it, what we look to in terms of excellence and celebration. But that, I think, is a structural thing, right? Has there, you know, why are we not elevating the stories of, there would be epic people from Bangladesh, you know, and what can we do to be a part of that? Yeah,
I think you're right. I think I have to get over there to get stuck into it, to, you know, to really kind of, it's probably on me actually more than anyone, to just get stuck into it and to be part of it, and then pass those stories along. Hey, what about, so you talked about that experience, and then obviously you were growing up in Melbourne, and then you sort of came back to Melbourne and you said your eyes were opened. What about the experience as a teenager in Melbourne? How was that then? Did you experience racism? Was it very inclusive? Did you fit in? Did you not care about fitting in? What was that like?
I guess this is like a two-prong thing or a three-prong thing. Yes, I felt included in my home. Outside of the home, however, it was interesting to see people's perceptions of the place that I lived. So I grew up in a suburb called Clayton in Melbourne, and Clayton is the kind of suburb that by and large people would turn their nose up at, like as if like, oh, that's a problematic suburb where there's, you know, crime and lower income. And it was interesting to see a visceral reaction when people would respond to the word Clayton. Whereas for me, inside our four walls was acceptance, stories, warmth, generosity, like, you know, peace. It was all the things that were opposite to this word. And so perception, I think, is really interesting. And growing up in primary school, it was super multicultural. We celebrated each other's cultures. I'm talking like Chile to El Salvador to the Philippines. Like it was Yugoslavia. It was like endless. Croatia, Greece, Italy. Like everybody was from every corner of the world. And we acknowledged that. We saw that. We celebrated that. And it wasn't until, like, I feel like as I was growing up and went into high school, the whiter school education became. All of our teachers were pretty much white, as opposed to, like, you know, a couple of brown teachers or an Asian teacher in primary school. And I was under a Catholic, patriarchal school. That was, you know, at the time, you know, George Pell was our archbishop, and we had a principal that I felt like really respected him, and I just never understood that. And now, for obvious reasons, you can see why. Like, but not that I understood, like, that I knew about the abuse, absolutely. But I just knew that he was an egomaniac. There were just things that just weren't congruent with the spirituality that Christianity espouses, right? And so I just saw this disconnect and this absolute hypocrisy, and I didn't want to opt in to the school system as much, which is why I skipped school so much in my early years and stayed home and watched Oprah Winfrey, because I was like, that's where it's at for me. Like, Oprah seems to be talking the truth, or as much of as a truth, and she seems to be the most self-aware than anybody in this system. And I just pushed back on all of it. And I also pushed back, I feel like part of me was like this gay woman inside of me that was not yet fully out of the closet, that was just rejecting these ideas of how to be a woman in the world. I didn't like it under this sort of patriarchal church religious structure. But, you know, after my trip to Ghana, I realized that that was the card that I'd been dealt with. So I just played my hand, and I played it well, in terms of, you know, I just took it as it was. I didn't have to agree to it, but I still had to play along. I still played along with VCE. I got my straight A's. I got 96.85 as my enter score at the end of the year, as I devoted myself to school, but there was still a part of me just calling bullshit on some of it, you know?
Yeah. And how did that was making me wonder, before you kind of really knuckled down and got stuck into it, how did that that kind of mainly white Catholic patriarchy react to your attitude? Was it the obvious, oh, here's an angry black female, you know, she's just playing the typical?
No, it wasn't like that at all, thankfully. Like, I think it was just like, she's just not coming to school. Why isn't your daughter coming to school? Like, I didn't turn tables or anything at the school. My God, if you did, it was the kind of school that if you did something really minor, you would get suspended. So it was like the punitive element of it meant that you couldn't really speak your mind anyway. It was just thoughts that were brewing in my head, you know. And I mean, like, I was racialized very, very early on, and I could see that too. But these are the sorts of fights I couldn't pick at the time. I ended up becoming school captain, and like, that is the weirdest thing. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yes, I know. That's amazing.
But the thing that I kind of pitched to the class, because we had this political rift within the school where all these girls left our year level because of a change of principal or whatever. And I think a lot of the parents that were involved with this school took their kids out, but they were like the kind of the all-star girls that like were the household names, that did all the sports, that did everything. And then what was left of the rest of the year was like a bunch of, I feel like, misfits. I call them, it was like the Mighty Ducks. We were just like, what do we do now? Like, all the A team have gone. But really, it exposed for us, like, it gave us room to grow. It gave us room to just, like, allow our voices to be heard, even if it was just within our friendship circles. And we grew from that. And I remember saying to the front of my year level as we were deciding who would become captain, I just said, I just represent, like, each and every one of you. Like, I'm an everyday person. I am just trying as hard as you can. Like, I'm not exceptional at all. Like, that was myself, because it was the truth. And but really, like, I will devote myself to this job, you know, I will devote myself to the role. And we did. And that's the thing. And that's all that's required of us each and every day, is to just try. You know, beat your fears and do the things that make you uncomfortable and push yourself further. You know, extraordinary comes out of ordinary.
Yeah, amazing. I mean, who was who or what was, because obviously your dad wasn't around, your mum and your family were, but who was sort of influencing and inspiring you throughout this? You've mentioned Oprah, obviously, was a big hero of yours. I think you talked about Will Smith and Lauryn Hill, but were there other sort of influences, you know, hip-hop music or rap music or other cultural sort of influences?
Besides
or people?
The hard work of my mother, which I respect and love always, every day, I feel like, rappers, I feel like actually not rappers, but I think Destiny's Child was the biggest one for me. And you think about how far they've right. come with Beyonce, or how far Beyonce's come now, you can kind of see why. That yeah. sort of DNA was already within Destiny's Child to begin with. Yes, it was a, you know, Beyonce light, TM, but it was there was enough breadcrumbs that were left for women like myself, women of color, that needed to look to somebody who was like killing it as much as you could in the pop music industry at the time, and giving us anthems to turn to. And I'll tell you what, I didn't realize how important they were until I was kind of coming to terms with my sexuality and facing a lot of homophobia in my like 20s, that stuff literally made me survive. Literally would not be on this earth if it wasn't for listening and hearing the words of Destiny's Child. That's how important music is to me. It's like, it can be a source of celebration. It can be a source of identity. And sometimes it can just save your life and make you feel seen in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yeah.
I suppose that's partly the theme of this podcast, actually. Obviously, advertising far less glamorous than the music world, but just for youngsters to see that people that are like them and look like them can actually be successful in an area is just a massive, massive thing. So I imagine that for you as a kid, as a teenager, there in your Melbourne suburb with not that many black kids in the community, to turn on the telly and see like these amazing ladies just kind of top of the pile and just kicking ass must have been super inspiring.
It was everything for us. And I guess it like leads into like present day conversations now, which I'm sure we'll get to with the political movements that are happening right now, like how important representation is. And beyond that, how much we need to change structures to allow storytellers to tell their stories from their own mouths and have little interference from anybody else, you know?
I mean, yeah, I mean, let's get into it, because I really do want to get into, you know, what's going on in the world right now, the Black Lives Matter movement, all of those things. I suppose just the link from what we were just talking about to that is, like, one of my favourite hip-hop groups, bands, whatever you could call it, is and has always been Public
Amazing.
Enemy. Chuck D had this thing that he said when I was a teenager that just always kind of resonated with me. He said that Public Enemy's music was like CNN for black people.
I love it.
And that just always made me think. I was like, why would he say that? And then I kind of, even as a teenager, I kind of realized that, okay, the media is set up in a certain kind of way and it's not going to necessarily tell the stories of everyone, of a certain kind of people. And you need other voices like Public Enemy or whoever to be those voices and to get that information out there.
So true.
So that's always kind of, yeah, driven me. What, I mean, how are you feeling right now? How are you feeling today? It's, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is in full swing. You've obviously been involved in these conversations for years. I watched an interview you did with one of the founders and leaders of Black Lives Matter, DeRay McKeeson, at the Antidote Festival at the Opera House in 2019. The theme of that session was the murder of Michael Brown in Ferguson, and obviously the protests in Ferguson, the birth of that movement. You know, it's been horribly, tragically mirrored again with George Floyd. Does that make you throw up your hands and say, "Oh shit, nothing's changed. It's the same old cycle again and again"? Or how are you feeling?
I feel that this moment has really emboldened myself. But then if you look at how the world has responded to Black Lives Matter used to be something that was regionally specific to Ferguson. That's it. It's now gone global. Black Lives Matter was something that Hillary Clinton was afraid of, like, approaching publicly ahead of her election. Now this is something that any smart political leader who wants to embrace a larger community, they would embrace BLM, right? So I like that shift from my chat with DeRay. It wasn't even a year ago when we were talking about Black Lives Matter in Ferguson, and that shift from then till now, holy shit. It is so huge. The fact that people now are realizing shit, like what, like this is the system of racism, and the conversation of racism is moving away from more of individual things that, you know, your auntie says in the household, to actually talking about the structure of racism, the racist structures that we live in, right? That stem from colonization, that stem from slavery, and how it bleeds into present day, right? and how it affects us today. Yeah. And I think that the removal of that cognitive dissonance of that has been huge. And people, especially our white friends, I would hope, I don't know about your world, Ant, finally picking up the mantle and finally realizing, shit, I'm a part of this system as well. I've benefited from white supremacy, and there is a level of my life in the way that white people behave that constantly focuses on position and ownership. And I too need to relearn but also more importantly, unlearn my racism and all the ways in which I've conditioned to believe that I can own everything and have a stake on everything. So I think that flip instead of just looking at black people to going, oh, you poor people, what's happening to you? Just go, well, actually, how am I a part of the problem as a white person? Then I'm talking for white people, but then how am I a part of the problem, me as an immigrant to Australia? Do you know what I mean? How do I re-educate myself, unlearn my own biases, and also elevate and make space for voices that do not identify directly with me, but I too need to be accomplice too, right? Because people have been asking for change in Australia. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders have been asking for change from the jump. And here we come in, we migrate here, we benefit off the country's success, and we've got to embrace its failures too, right? So I think that that's been kind of the bigger overarching themes that inform our daily lives. I don't know what it's like for you, Ant. How have you responded to all of this? Because this is, I feel like, been something that has affected everybody.
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm not black, I'm brown, but so there's some sort of shared experiences there. But a couple of sort of things I was thinking as you talked there were some friends of mine who said to me, very unracist friends have said to me, in conversations, yeah, but what's the big deal? Because, I'm not racist and I would never feel that way. I just kind of see you as Ant, or, I see my friends of color as whoever they are. I don't see that.
Okay, stop color. Right there. And stop right there. Do you find that problematic?
Totally.
Yep. Okay, why?
Absolutely. Because I felt like we worked this through in the conversation. I said, well, because you've totally ignored and not recognized my experience in the world, or our experience in the world, just seeing it through your own eyes and through your own point of view. I think one of the best things I saw on this, I don't know if you came across this, Faustina, was Banksy, the graffiti artist. Banksy did an artwork around it and put out a post on Instagram, and he said, I've been seeing the Black Lives Matter movement kicking off, taking place, moving on, progressing. I didn't think at first. I thought I shouldn't say anything in this conversation. It's not my place or my right to say anything. And then this is Banksy speaking. He said, and then I realised, hang on a second, it's not their problem. It's my problem. I need to fucking sort it out. Not them. And that's how I feel about it. We, as in people of color, have been talking about this and banging the drum for years. But I think it's only now, to your point, that other people, as in white people, are starting to kind of go, oh, right, okay, I see what you mean. Mm-hmm. Right, okay, you're feeling like that. And I don't know, it saddens me. I don't want to be a moaner, seen as a moaner, or, oh, he's going on about it again. Oh, the diversity thing, or you feel like this, we've already said. I feel like the biggest thing I feel is that it's time for the world to stop saying they are, or being not racist, and to start being anti-racist, to start seeing it from a different point of view and actually speaking out and saying those things. That's where my head's at.
Well,
how about you?
The thing that tipped the scales for me, Ant, was when the black tiles started showing up on Instagram. Oh.
Yeah, how did you feel about that? I was so conflicted.
That made me so angry. I wasn't conflicted. That just pissed me off. Right. And it was because I was seeing people that have not once picked up a book on anti-racism, not once ever acknowledged race and them themselves being a race. And this is my peers in radio, in podcasting, in television, in advertising, you name it, any medium, all of a sudden posting black tiles and hashtag Black Lives Matter. Are you serious? Are you serious? I snapped and I posted something on my socials just to say, and plus it was the, like, it had nothing, the black tie had nothing to do with allyship or nothing to do with being an accomplice for an Australian context. It has nothing to do with it. It had everything to do with the music industry, which I already find problematic in the US. People like white companies taking time off to learn about, you know, racism and their involvement in it. But then also as a, these hashtags that were attached to it have to do with the actual root Black Lives Matter movement, where people were trying to find resources for each other, bail funds for people that were protesting on ground. And then, you know, resources to make sure that they were protected, or like ways to get around voter suppression in the States. And here the rest of the world is attaching these, like, you know, hashtags that takes 2 seconds of their time and clogging up the digital space from the activist roots.
Yeah.
So like that already was like so wild. And I think that, I mean, that is also the nature of the internet and the virality of it, like of things spreading and missing its original intention. But what it also exposed was people jumping on a bandwagon to try and opt into something that they didn't really have an intimate knowledge about, but they didn't want to be seen as a shithead for not like opting into a movement, right? But by doing so, they were exposing actually the gaps of knowledge that they had about anything to do with race, the black race specifically, right? And that's why I snapped, because I was like, okay, you're going to post a black tile? What are you doing? What are you actually doing to be anti-racism? Are you reading books? Have you donated to the Black Lives Matter movement? Have you donated to the numerous campaigns to find justice for numerous Aboriginal deaths in custody that are on change.org, or you know, have you signed petitions? Like, are you going to the rallies? Like, and then, you know, a couple of people reached out to me that I used to work at Channel 10 and going, well, Fuzz, we're just going to have to agree to disagree. Isn't it like just acknowledging the point? And it's just like, well, mate, can you do some research first before we have this conversation? And then when I told them to do the research, they came back to me and they were like, fuck, we fucked up. I'm so sorry. Right.
Mm.
And that was just because I was willing to engage with a couple of those friends from Channel 10. But
that's amazing that they came back though and said, yeah. Shit,
yeah. Okay. Yeah. And they can understand and justify the anger. And then somebody else pulled me up, like a woman who works in Bondi, and was just like, hey, I don't really like your tone. So tone policing me, which is an act of racism. And I decided to post something about, you know, asking a black person to not be angry now or ever is the equivalent of telling a woman during the Me Too movement to smile more. And it's the way that I've been able to convey a message to white people is always offering up some sort of analogy that centers their whiteness, unfortunately. Unfortunately, because it gets the message across. But I had to, because most of my followers are white women, I had to tell them, like, imagine, you know, you've, you know, worked in a workplace that has been largely male skewed your whole life. Let's say you're a woman who's been working in television in the 90s. And, you know, the workplace is full of men. No one fully sees you. You're sexualized all the time. There's Playboy magazines lying on set, which used to happen. And, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's present day. And let's say there's a movement that's begun. Let's say it's Me Too. And then all of a sudden, like, people have decided that they're going to post pink tiles on their Facebook page or their Instagram in support of Me Too. And not once has any of these people stood up for you in the workplace, or like batted for you to have equal pay, or to like create inclusive policies so that you're not harassed. The goal for people to do that, to declare that, just to show some sort of allyship, and I say that with like quote air quotation marks, like you would be offended by that. That would piss you fucking off, right? And then you had the Women's March. There were women that had PTSD during that time. There were women that grieved. And there were women that were very, very fucking angry, right? Civility gets you to some place of change, but so does anger, right? So I'm allowed to be angry at any time. I'm allowed to be angry about this. because you haven't heard us this whole time. And it doesn't matter what tone I bring it to you with, right? You don't seem to hear it, so I'm going to yell now. I'm going to tell you off for posting a black tile because we have asked for diversity things time and time again. We've asked for to tell our own stories time and time again. Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders have been doing it for a couple of hundred years now. You know what I mean? Like, stop with this foolishness. So, and then once I focus that, like, once I draw the focus on, let's say this happened, like this hypocritical thing happened with Me Too and pink tiles, they get it.
Yeah.
They get it.
Yeah.
Right? And I think we need to have these difficult conversations. We need to make people feel uncomfortable. And therefore, white people will be humbled enough to do the work, to pick up some books, to go buy, you know, from black storytellers, to then go out and march on the streets. Because it's one thing to be quiet in the home, but you got to be yelling on the streets, and you got to be donating, and you've got to be championing structural change.
Just do action.
Be active in your life. I mean,
You just talked, Faustina, about you mentioned a couple of times one word and a couple of times another word, and I've just kind of allies. You mentioned allies, and then you mentioned accomplice.
Yep.
What's the difference there between those two
There's
words?
Actually,
ally and accomplice.
Ally is I feel like it's an empty word, and like there's actually been a writer that's written a book about the problem with allyship, which I can bring up later in this podcast because I don't have the writer's name to me at the moment. But allyship has become like this empty sort of use of a word in the which some people try and use the word diversity, that it stands in for something that they're not doing. So if you say I'm an ally, DeRay's also talked about this too. It's just like somebody could be waving a rainbow flag and going, yay, like waving from the sidelines. You're not doing much. You're not very active. You're choosing to opt in and out when it suits you, right? And you're constantly choosing comfortability. So an ally could be like, yeah, we care for Black Lives Matter, but then like go to the peace and unity side of things, like spiritually bypassing the difficult work to just do surface level stuff. Do you know what I'm saying? Or like posting a black tile and like that's it. Like that's the level of involvement that they have. And then an accomplice though consistently puts themselves in positions where they feel uncomfortable, calls things out on a consistent basis, full time. There's no gray area, right? And it's an active part of their life, reading anti-racism education regularly, like constantly learning, listening, sitting down, listening, shutting up and just listening and taking things in, right? Shifting their worldview. And then there is co-conspirator, which is like the ultimate level where people are not quitting until there is huge structural change. And co-conspirator are the people, the principals at places where, you know, if the ratio, let's say in a multicultural school or a school that's like largely brown and black, but, you know, this particular school is privileged and is like majority accepting white kids, it's switching the ratio. Like more brown kids of that community going to that school and receiving the benefits of that school as opposed to white kids coming in from miles away and benefiting off this, you know, precious school in a brown community or something, for example. Like that's just a small example. It's running an advertising agency and batting for casting where somebody is, you know, brown or somebody is Asian and, you know, seeing that they are Australian too and showing that it's not just the white Aussie bloke that's Australian. I don't know, selling a car or something. Like it's making these critical decisions that help shift the gaze and help shift the power structures, but then also championing women and women of color to have their own agencies and to have their own authority and their own voice, you know, for the things that we use in our daily lives, which is what your job is, right? It's like telling stories for the things that we use in our daily lives, right? And, you know, to bring a new lens to that. So, and that to be seen, to be emboldened by the images that we see is crucial. I'm tired of seeing, you know, people dying, our people dying. I'm tired of seeing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders dying and being humiliated and tortured. Shouldn't be happening.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, DeRay, because I watched that interview that you did with DeRay, I watched it online, and DeRay said this thing that you just reminded me of. He said that hope is the belief that our tomorrows can be better than our todays. Hope is not magic. Hope is work. And that's kind of all those kind of concrete, tangible things you're talking about there is kind of how I see the work. I kind of, I don't know if you were there, but I went to the rally, the Black Lives Matter rally in Sydney, and I thought it was amazing. It was really positive. It was a great atmosphere. It was there was a lot of anger. There was a lot of people from all different backgrounds, indigenous people, brown people, black people, white people, and so on. It felt like a really good tipping point. So I came back and I was inspired and I was sort of lit up. But I did kind of wonder and worry that, you know, that was on Saturday, you know, job done, Monday morning, nothing changes. We all move on with our lives and that's kind of done. The things you're talking about are a lot longer, more commitment over a longer period of time to make sure that, you know, things really, really do change. Would you agree? Because it's not that I don't want people to go to the rallies. Like I say, the rally was amazing, but I just don't want the rally. Yeah, you know, although the black square thing as well, you know, a bit like the black square. I just don't want it to be a moment in time and then everyone thinks, oh, job done. Let's get on with our lives as it was before. I want it to be the starting point, not the end point. I don't want people to say to me, oh yeah, but I went to the rally, or, you know,
I did the one thing,
or I donated and that was it. Yeah. I want it to be an ongoing. Now, for example, you mentioned advertising in this world, in the world of advertising, with me and a couple of mates, brown friends are starting a thing called the Adland Action Agenda, which is around trying to lobby agencies to bring in more people of color, have those discussions, have solid concrete figures around people of color in leadership positions, people of color coming into the industry, representation in ads. You know, that, as you say, you turn on the TV and you would think that the average Australian family is a certain way, and we all know the reality of it is not that. That's just the small world of advertising. But I want and I hope that these conversations and these ongoing commitments are taking place in everywhere, in every kind of industry around the country.
Yeah, I 1,000% agree. And I think that, I mean, you know, you're referring to this as a small industry, but it's such a powerful one, you know? Like you guys, you're a part of these enormous accounts that churn millions, if not billions of dollars of profit. That affects the world globally. And it's not just like a soda or something, like the apparel. And then what does that mean for its supply chain? And how is it affecting the environment? And how is it affecting the people that actually make these garments? Are they being paid fairly? Is there fair trade? Like, I feel like there needs to be a holistic approach to this new level of advertising and branding. You're a part of this massive machine that we are consumers of, and it's a capitalist machine. So not only is there like what, you know, having representation within the workplace, but how are these companies, can you put pressure on these companies to have a social justice element, to look after its people, right? Pay them properly, not just like going for profit all the time. And I feel like there is a market leader in Patagonia. I think that they're probably the best company in terms of how a company should operate. Yes, they have their flaws, but I think that that is like the model company for me. I don't think I've ever seen any other company perform the way that they do in terms of their devotion for the environment and looking after their supply chains and making sure that people are looked after and within their own factories where, you know, their clothes are being made, you know, there's been times where there's been slavery, like people being traded through the system and them having to clean up that situation themselves, you know, they're getting their hands dirty. So it's like, I feel like it needs to be baked in. And the other thing is that I've really taken a lot of inspiration from Angela Davis, for a long time, but more so now, where she talks about diversity, right? And she has this quote where she says, I have a hard time accepting diversity as a synonym for justice. Like she's like, diversity is a corporate strategy, right? Diversity without structural transformation simply brings those who were previously excluded into a system as racist misogynist as it was before, right? And you would know the kinds of racism I'm talking about, Ant, because you would have experienced it, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then she continues, I have problems with that term because that seems to be the term that has colonized all of our struggles for social justice. All you need to do is mention the word diversity, and it stands in for anti-racist work. It stands in for work against homophobia. It stands in for everything, and it can mean nothing, right? I'm not saying diversity is not important. It can be, but you have to have a strong concept of diversity. Unless we combine diversity and social justice, we can end up with the notion that diversity means difference that makes no difference at all. Within that conversation, she also brings up the type of people that we bring into a workplace. So you could just tick superficial diversity boxes, but if the people that we're bringing in that represent a particular ethnicity, Asian, Indian, Native American, they also need to have a sense of social justice, because you could end up, this is Angela Davis's word, you could end up with like a diverse looking group that are probably conservative, if not more conservative than the white folk, right? And so there needs to be a greater discernment in what we do in our practices. And, you know, it starts with the self, analyzing the self, and then our communities, right? And making sure that the communities are aligned with our values, especially steeped in social justice, especially steeped in how we look after the world that we live in, so that we have an environment that's available for our children for decades to come, years and years to come. If we don't have that holistic view, I think we're failing each other.
It's difficult, isn't it? Advertising, as you're going back to the advertising thing, advertising is, some people call advertising art in service of capitalism, which I think is a fair description. And I think a lot of agency owners, particularly the network agencies, are happy to take the dollar because, that's the way it works. I think I run a smaller mm-hmm. agency, and what that gives us is the freedom to, to make our own decisions, to work out who we want to work with, and also, even more important, who we won't work with. And that's, I think that's only sort of exists more so outside of the big network agency structure. It's harder in that world. I mean, just on that, the Angela Carter thing and diversity and so on, I really wanted to ask you, Faustina, you obviously have done all sorts of work in TV, theatre, media. You were one of the first, or if not the first, black model for mm-hmm. Bonds. In all of these worlds around media, music, TV, and so on, how did you find that? Were the levels of not just diversity then, but to your point, diversity in a sense of social justice? How were they? Did you find that social justice and diversity were in those places, or sadly lacking?
I would say in the ad world, it was lacking enormously, and I think that it does work for optics and profit. And this is like I will forever be grateful to Bonds for the opportunity to be on their ad, but I wouldn't have gotten it if it didn't work for them too, right? And it was because Bonds had wanted to expand in the UK that year, and they had bought up window space at Selfridges, so it was interesting that, you know, I had been cast to be in this campaign with Miranda Kerr and another model. Her name's Danielle Marie Grasso. She's from America. To be in this campaign, but it was in service to the black community in the UK, really. Like that was, and the theme of like the underwear was mix and match, right? And so it was like mixing solid color, block color with print. And, you know, here I am kind of flanked with these women, white women. So it was a very optical decision. I have a hard time thinking that, you know, companies such as these massive Australian iconic brands are actually genuinely diverse within the ranks of their creative team. Yeah. I would be surprised to see a 50% or more representation of like any other ethnicity other than white. Like, I can sense that there is some progress. I think with the recent queer campaign was interesting, like, it's, you know, supporting queer rights over the Mardi Gras period. But then there's other ads that I'm seeing, and I'm talking specifically to Bonds, like where I saw like a bus shelter where I noticed there were these black women who I assume were of the African diaspora who were Australian. And the, you know, how Bonds have like that giant lettering, and they said, they used African American English in this ad, and it said, "We gots you," gots plural. And it was off to me because all of a sudden it seemed that this brand did a hard turn and chose like African American, like slang, African American English to sell a product. It just seemed insincere, and it kind of reminds me of, I think it was the brand Iconic, where recently they did a, or last year they did a kind of like a parade at, like, I think it was that, where's that place at the swimming pool in the center of Sydney? Or maybe it was in Queensland, but like there was runway models that were walking, like, I think on a platform over a swimming pool or something. And it was kind of like, we are diverse. And it's just like, yeah, we get that. Like, you've purposely picked models, like it's not just enough. Like, it's
not enough.
It's not enough.
Very surface. It's just becomes totally surface.
A cop out. Like, and I don't mean to like burn these companies in the way that they're presenting it, but it's, you can tell that something's off. You can tell it's insincere. It's just like, get deeper, man. Like, get deeper with the people that you're hiring. Who's taking these photos? Is it still like, you know, the white photographer that's been photographing these people for 50 years? Like, come on. Like, where is the structural change that you're putting through the system? And are you making your garments ethically?
Yeah, sorry. I was just going to say that on that very point, Nike, I don't know if you caught any of this, but Nike have been involved in a bit of a conversation around that recently, because they've obviously spent years supporting equality and sort of, you know, empowerment of kids to do sport of all different nationalities and backgrounds. But they put out an ad that was supporting the Black Lives Matter movement. They've really supported Colin Kaepernick when he took the knee and he lost his job in sport and so on. But and that's amazing. But someone called them out because they don't have any people of color on their leadership team. So someone just said, "Look, guys, you've made like millions, using the pictures and backstories of amazing black athletes, like." And it's fine to put them in your ads, but you need to do more than that. They need to be on, you know, as part of your company.
But I also call bullshit on Nike too, on a deeper level. It's choosing Colin Kaepernick because they needed that youth money and a new way to make money and leverage off him, right? Love the fact that they supported Kaepernick, especially in a time of where people were so against him. However, Nike has also poured the same, if not more, money to right-wing organizations behind the scenes. There's articles about this. Yeah, for real, Ant. And it hasn't been blown up to the level or magnitude that it needs to be. So I call bullshit on Nike for that reason. And so it's just like the internet is a wonderful place to sleuth and to find proof of where companies are, if they're being transparent with you or not. So, I mean, I'm sorry to end this podcast with like a disdain for like brands in a way, but I think it's important to be critical at this time and to question our relationship to the things that we consume. I think it's really important that we do, because if we don't have these honest conversations and bring it to the forefront, then we're not going to have the society that we want, right? Which is an honest one, a one where there is equity, a one where people are treated fairly, you know, and we need to call things out when we see it, right? And so, you know, how do you want to end this? Like, what are some of the things that, because I've read about your agency and I've read that there was like 5% of profits goes to something that you choose, like, or love to embolden the lives of people. Like, what is that?
That thing for us is not, it's not a thing actually. It has to be a person. The reason we brought that 5% thing is because what we absolutely don't want to do is go, here's a check, we're going to give it to, you know, cancer research or whatever and Salvation Army and off we go. What we're trying to do is we're trying to find individuals who through no fault of their own have got a talent but haven't got the ability or the network or the resources or whatever it may be to fulfill their potential. And with our small kind of input and bit of help with that financial money can get them closer towards the training they need, or you know, the course they need to do, or the degree, or whatever it may be that might give them a chance of achieving that. So that's our small kind of promise.
I had a profound conversation with a friend of mine from Sydney University. His name is Vafa. He was the Sydney University medalist for that year. Like, he won the medal for being like the smartest student that year. And he is of a Baha'i faith, the Baha'i faith, which is, and he's Persian. And we met up in Europe because he was working there. And I think it was in Geneva. I spoke to him about a horrible relationship that I had been in, where this particular person kind of sold themselves as like a good person and kind of spoke in a nice way, but then the way that this person's actions were the opposite. And it really messed with my head for the time that I was in that relationship. And I'd spent years of therapy afterwards trying to unpack that form of gaslighting and being told something and it not being the truth.
Yeah.
And, he's the only friend that really responded in a way that was so profound. And he listened to me. He said, "I'm really sorry that this has happened." And he said, "You know, in the Baha'i teachings, they say that when you are seeking a romantic partner, it requires the critical and thorough investigation of the other individual's character." So I'll repeat that again for all the podcast people that are listening and have not been put off by my angry 20-minute rant during the podcast. When seeking a romantic partner requires the critical and thorough investigation of the other individual's character. That was profound for me. That was nothing that I was taught through a Catholic school, right? You're not taught to be discerning. Mm. You're not taught to understand people through a critical lens. It's not like you're trying to make somebody else's life difficult. You're trying to think, am I really believing the things that this person is saying? But more importantly, are their actions aligning with their words? Right? And that one teaching has helped inform me time and time again. Sure, I haven't gotten it right a bunch of times, but like it has been something that has grown within me. He planted seeds in me that day, and it has grown to the point that it's not just romantic relationships, and it's like every relationship in your life.
Yeah, the people you've got in your life, yeah.
And absolutely, the work that we do with the people that are in our lives. So that is the thing that I want to leave people with, is because in order for us to have, I think the most important growth is spiritual growth, personally, beyond the kind of fancy things that we could kind of get up to in our lives. Like, you know, the awards and stuff, they're all just like things that happen because we've chosen to apply ourselves to something. They actually don't mean anything in the end of the day. We're not taking our awards to the grave with us, right? They're not coming with us. You can't take that with you. Hmm. But what you can do is take your truth with you and take your experience with you. And hopefully it's imbued with love and respect and connection. And to know that you've left the world, hopefully somewhere in a good place than it was when you arrived. And with that, it starts with the self, and it starts with the discernment of the relationships that you bring into your life. And I hope that we continuously become more and more discerning and more truthful and humble to learn. I hope that our learning continues and it is a lifelong thing for us.
Faustina, that is amazing. That is such an amazing place to end it. Thank you so much. That was so insightful and inspiring, and most of all, just thank you so much for sharing so many personal, you know, really, really personal stories and insights there.
Thank you, Ant.
Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. You too. See ya. Hey! Okay, thank you to you for listening, and thank you to the guys at Smith & Weston for pulling this together. Dan and Nick here are absolute legends in sound. From creating original music tracks, stings and sound effects, to recording VOs, radio commercials and podcasts, they're master craftsmen, an absolute joy to work with, and genuine supporters of positive steps in the industry. So please keep them in mind for all your sound requirements. Thanks again. Until next time.